Hi, everyone. This is Austin welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, September 30th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites. The archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. Together, they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody online and ready to go? We're ready.
We sure are.
All righty. To start with our opening riff, comes from a session from Kuo that happened on May 18th, 1997. Kuo says, "As you attempt to serve others, always ask the self, what is being asked of you? For it is in response to what is asked that one may serve another. And upon a deeper level, as events impinge upon you, a good question to ask as a touchstone is, what does the Creator ask of you? The answer to this can be known only from the heart, only from the intuition. For what the Creator asks is often illogical, often puzzling. Even though one feels to do or not to do something, one cannot precisely explain why. But when there is a strong intuition, we recommend and encourage the will to follow that intuition."
Thanks, Austin. It's a very common thing to move from our care for someone to feel that we have something to help them. Not that they've asked us. No, they haven't asked for a thing. But we just feel that they could use our advice, our good wishes, whatever. And so we plunge in. And sometimes it's appreciated, and more often it's not appreciated. And we wonder, what went wrong? Did I do? I was just trying to help. The hardest thing in the world to do is to wait and listen. The idea is you support silently. You listen carefully, consciously, and you wait for the moment that that person asks you something. Then and only then do you have an appropriate venue for sharing your opinion. It's tough to wait. It's tough to listen. But that's what we need to do. Many times, we will be inundated by a friend's complaints. But if you listen carefully, you'll discover that they're not asking us for anything except a listening ear. They want to vent. They want to be understood. They want to feel your sympathy and you can do that simply by nodding and going, at the appropriate intervals. It has thrown me back in the old days many times because I figured, well, hey, here's a problem. Let's solve it. That's my approach. I don't let a problem sit on the ground festering in my own life. I sit down with it. I work it out, analyze logically, and figure out, can I do something or can I not? Is it just useless, vain worry? And if there's something I can do, I'm all over it. And if it's something between me and someone else, I ask for their kind listening ear and ask to sit down with them and talk it out. I don't avoid it. I see no reason to avoid it. We're good people here. And if we want to solve it, then we can, usually, by talking it through. Jim and I have made a lifetime of happiness for ourselves by every once in a while looking at each other and saying, we gotta talk. It used to be a dreaded little signal for Jim. He didn't know that you could actually solve anything. He'd never seen that. I had faith in it. So he worked with me, and wow, that was fast. We got that thing knocked out. And no harm, no foul. Nobody's mad. All right. And so he began to trust. And over the years, he and I have built on that trust until we simply, you know, work it out. I mean, 5 minutes every once in a while is not a burden. And that's about all it takes. Within the family, when there's something amiss, Gary can tell you, I go right for it. What's going on? Let's talk about it. Let's get this thing solved. And by golly, we do. Because I'm all, you know, totally willing to work, to understand, to listen, and to respond. I don't have to be right. Thing, guys, we don't have to be right. A lot of times we're wrong. That's okay. It's sort of a stumble bum on the way to getting it worked out. But always make sure before you begin to solve something that the other person actually wants to solve it. You can even ask, do you want to solve this thing? Because I think I have a way. And they'll tell you, no, I'm just talking. It's as though part of their safety as a person is wrapped up in having this problem. I am the person who has a bad father. I am the person who has an unfaithful husband. I am the person who has an ungrateful boss. For some reason, these masks, misidentities that are allowed to stay, become a part of people. And they can't bear to have that ripped away. Another example, don't tell an alcoholic that he needs to stop drinking unless he asks. Don't tell somebody who's getting high all the time that he needs to stop doing that. He knows. Your friend knows. He doesn't want to deal with it yet. It's too helpful to him. The support he's getting from the habit is too supportive to him. to give it up yet. He will in the future when he's a little bit stronger. But for now, leave it alone. Wait for him to ask, or her. I don't mean to be sexually misdirecting. Men and women alike have these problems. It doesn't mean that you're weak if you don't feelings of, I can help, here, let me help. It means that you have gained some maturity and you are ready to be more of a responsive friend. The responsive friend simply wants to support in any way that's helpful. Sometimes listening is all important. Not solving the problem, but just letting that person vent, letting her get it out. Oh, it feels so good when she can just run through the details and have your sympathy. Oh, yeah, I see where that would hurt. I'm sorry for that. The next step, would you like to solve that problem? That's not part of being a good friend before you're asked. I don't mean to nag at this point, but it's so all important. Later on, the quote from Kuhl reminds you not just to ask the person what that person wants, but to ask the Creator what it wants from you. That's a much more subtle thing. For that, you need to go within, into the silence. Rest in that silence and ask. Ask and it shall be given unto you, it says in the Bible. And it's true. You don't get the answer out of nowhere. You get it by asking. You get it by trusting that there's somebody listening to you and ready to respond. Now, the way that spirit works, the responses are not often clear. You might turn the radio on, and the first song on the radio is your answer. That has happened to Jim more times than I can remember. And it's very inspiring how that works. It works differently for different people. Jim's very sensitive to lyrics. I have had the answer come to me in an animal sighting, my totem, my owl, or my hawk. A street sign with the keyword in the street sign. I'm passing along. There it is. The spirit uses all of nature and all of the dance to choose the way of response. It's not usually in English. You know, here's what you need to do. You don't get that kind of answer. You get a knowing, a feeling, an intuition, a powerful intuition that the Creator wants something. And you check it, and you check it again at least 3 times just to make sure. And then you can move on that. But it is very subtle work, and it's not for the faint-hearted. It takes concentration and faith. It's a waiting game a lot of times. But if we want to serve others, we have all the time in the world, because all we're looking for is an opportunity to be of genuine help to our brothers and sisters. It's wonderful to find out, usually long after the fact, that you, but it's not important. You can't start being attached to the outcome here. You do your best and you let it go. Your joy comes from having the opportunity to try, to give it a good whack with everything you've got. And you know what? I bet you'll be surprised at how successful you are.
Thank you so much, Carla. And before we go to our questions that were sent in, I think we have a friend on the line calling in. Caller from area code 801, you're on the air. Is this JP?
It is. Thank you, guys.
Hi, JP. How you doing?
Good. Hope everybody there is doing great.
Indeed.
Hi. Is it okay if it's a single subject, but it has three main distinct parts? Can I ask a three-part question?
Yeah, sure. I don't see why not. We can tackle
okay.
a three-part question.
Thanks. So you want it all at once or part by part?
Well, we'd better hear it all at once first, and then we can take it part by part.
Okay. Well, you wrote the Wanderer's Guide or Handbook, and in chapter 15, the Devotionally Lived Life, there's a section of 5 pages, and everything is quoted and footnoted by Quo for September 23rd, 1990, and the section's called Cooperating with Destiny, and the main sentence that I'm trying to understand, if I may read it, it says, if you can trust destiny enough to release the attempts to control it, the natural waves of energy moving out from the center of that kindly destiny, which is each seeker's, will gradually take that seeker upon the path and in the direction which is deeply desired. But this word, natural waves of energy, so that kind of makes me think that somebody or logos or hierarchy is making or manipulating or moving or stirring or doing something to energy that's going to affect incidences that happen in my life. And if that's true, I'm just curious about who, what, when, where, why does all that, how does all that happen without infringing on our free will? That's the first part.
Okay.
I
can answer the first part.
Okay.
Before we are born into an incarnation, we sit down with our guides, our higher self, spirit, whatever kindly souls we have chosen to guide us. And we talk over what we would really like to accomplish in this incarnation in terms of coming more into balance with the energies of love and wisdom and power. And so we choose incarnational lessons, and we choose redundantly, mind you, people that will help us to achieve a success with these lessons. So we are the force of destiny in our own lives. Nobody's pushing us around. The energies that come from the very center are the energies that we have set into motion before the incarnation so that we might learn more and more how to balance ourselves as we hope to balance ourselves. Is that satisfactory? Do you need more discussion?
Well, you used the word center or centers? Does that mean center of the galaxy or center of the sun or center of my soul? Where is my game plan stored at, and where does that energy come from?
Well, it's stored in all three places because they're all the same. One is, you know, more of a macrocosm, one's more of a microcosm, one's personal, one's more from the standpoint of the creator, but it harmonizes in being our personal center, so that we can trust this in terms of a balance point. Like riding a bicycle, you need balance, and we can trust that the energies that are suggesting try this, you know, intuit that, come from a very trustworthy source. Our own desires to fulfill our destiny as souls in this incarnation as we have set it up. I think the guys ought to be able to weigh in on this because I'm not the only one with a good idea. Anybody?
The best that I could really say is talking about the center is similar to what you're saying, Carla. There's sort of a center that's shared between you and your higher self, and I would assume even in a greater level shared with the creator itself. But in terms of planning our incarnations and the experiences that we have during our incarnations, it does in a way come from ourself, but it is just sort of the paradox of third density that we can't realize that. It is sort of our own creation of our experiences. And that's my best understanding. It's hard to put into words because I don't think it's really something that can fully be grasped by our third density intellectual capacities.
Right. It's not logical. Mm-hmm. It comes from the heart.
In a very general way to answer it, JP's question regarding where this information, this plan, so to speak, is stored. In a really general way, I would just say within us. It's in our energy patterns, in our chakras, in our biases, in our physical DNA, and it's reflected in the circumstances around us, like Carla was getting at, the people that we work with and have been raised with, et cetera. So it's all around us and in us.
Mickey, what do you think?
Well, after, you know, reading the book we just read about this process, I'd recommend checking the book out just to find out how people can get together before incarnations to make a rather detailed plan and various alternatives if one thing or other doesn't work. It's Dr. Michael Newton, The Journey of Souls. And in there he talks about what happens to a newly dead soul from Earth that's now wishing to look back on the incarnation, see how it was done, what the lessons that were hoped for were, and where they met. And then if there's any healing necessary to undertake that, and then to look forward to the next incarnation, do you know, you need to learn some of the same things more intensively or other balancing learnings. It's a very intricate and powerful process from what I can determine, but it's one that is seen as very normal. It's a very normal part of the progression of all souls that spring from the Creator.
And luckily and happily, it agrees with the Law of One. So there's no swearing of philosophies there. I really enjoyed that book. Jim read it to me while I was in the hospital these last 5 days. And I thought it was a dynamite book. I really did. Very helpful. Michael Newton?
Right.
Uh-huh. We found out latterly that he's written 3 books, actually, so we're looking forward to getting and reading the other 2.
Well, that ain't a bad answer. Thanks. The second quick part is
part number two.
Yeah.
Sitting right along.
Thanks. It's kind of for Jim. Is there a metaphysical difference between what happens to you and it's considered destiny or fate?
Well, those are just terms of use to describe what seem to be larger forces working in a person's life. And I think really it's a whole lot more the person's pre-incarnated choices that are working than what seems to be destiny. I mean, there might be energies of a certain sort that are going on in a culture. The cultures are looked at to see as what they've got to offer, and different time periods and different cultures and different planets, I mean, have various opportunities, and you can choose whatever you wish and put it in motion, and it'll be perceived in some fashion, you hope, by yourself in the incarnation. So you can call it whatever you want, but it's part of what you've put in motion yourself. It really is.
Well, I find that a very profound answer, because one of the main sentences in the Course in Miracles says, remember that you do all of this to yourself. So that really fits in with other teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And the last quick part is my favorite shrink was Carl Jung, and he discovered this thing, synchronicities. I got a feeling that somehow he's talking about remnants or consequences that happen from destiny or fate, and it's seen in our illusionary world as these synchronicities. Is that true or not?
Yeah, apparently we are very careful in making certain signposts available that we will recognize. And synchronicities are a really good way of the subconscious communicating with the conscious mind that there is something of essence, something of importance, something to really pay attention to happening. And that's not by chance either.
Okay.
Jung kind of struggled with attempting to define synchronicity in a kind of a metaphysical way, because he knew that that would kind of be unacceptable in his field. In his essay about synchronicity, he just goes on, he basically obviously believes that there are some greater forces at play behind synchronicity, but he tries really hard to seem ambiguous about it and to simply make a suggestion and to leave open the possibility that it's just our own mind making connections that it thinks are significant when they're not very significant. But if you read it, it really is obvious that he believes there's something greater at work there.
Hmm. So he's really fighting his training.
Yeah, I think that maybe he wasn't necessarily fighting with himself, but just making sure that he didn't get pushed too far into the fringes, because he had already sort of departed from Freud into the fringes of occultism.
I see.
And basically started searching for these higher answers that Freud was very insistent that he did not go searching for, which I think is where their main split happened, was essentially in the research of occultism, because Freud thought occultism was all infantile delusion, basically. And Jung realized that in the symbolism and in the ritual, there was something deeper and something that was perhaps transcendent instead of a precursor to development. Does that answer your questions, JP?
Yeah, it really does. That's very good. And speaking about Jung and bridging on getting out into woo-woo land, one of his last books on UFOs, no modern psychologist would even dare touch that subject. So he was quite cutting edge. Thanks, everybody. It's been nice, and appreciate your help, and appreciate all the words and all the teachings. Thanks so much.
Oh, God bless.
Thanks, JP.
Thank you, JP.
Thank you, JP.
Alrighty. Now, back to our questions that were sent in. Our first question comes from Adne1, via the Bring Forth forums. Adne One asks, as according to the literal law of one, not the book, but the singular law, all things being one, universal love is defined as realizing a complete awareness of all people and all things, believing all expressions of all things are your own, and knowing all beliefs of all things are your own. Do you or do you not agree? Why and how?
I think one initial difficulty in tackling this particular question is that Adne One draws a distinction between the literal, what he calls the actual law of one, and the law of one that's in printed form in the books. And the actual law of one, as Ra says, can only be approximated with words. Words are never going to capture that law of one. Words are never going to the law of one. You know, we have to fall back on words and use approximations only. So I think that's a good caveat to keep in mind. And then in tackling his question from my own perspective, I think I may delve into semantics, but hopefully in examining Adne One's word choice, we could tease out some meaning or some insight at least. So I have 3 points I'd like to respond with. And the first is that he said believing in his question. And from my perspective, the actual experience or the knowing or the seeing, whichever verb you want to use, of all things as self is not a believing precisely. Though one can certainly believe in that, can have an intellectual formulation of that, but the actual perception or experience stems from being, and the being that the incarnational self becomes increasingly conscious of. So we could say aware being. It's not an intellectual process or an intellectual capacity, though, of course, the intellect can be of aid in that. The second point is, Adne One said, knowing all beliefs as your own. Believing all expressions of all things are your own. So who is your when you say your own? If it is the incarnational self, the self that exists in the mind and in space and time, that conceptual self that will die, that's not quite the depth of the self to which the law of one material points. That's not the your of the law of one. There are, of course, many seeming gradations of self with which the law of one identifies, from the personality shell to the incarnational self, to the higher self, to the mind-body-spirit totality, to the other self, to the first density self or second density self,
et
cetera. Archetypal, yeah. And ultimately to the self that is all, that is one, that is unity and infinity and eternity and whatever other adjectives we can come up with to describe that. So if it's to the infinite self to which your statement refers, then from my philosophical understanding, yes, all things are one with you. All things are your own in a sense. But also the notion of your own could, if approached in a certain way, imply some sort of possessiveness. And the actual experience of the law of one, the actual being, the isness of knowing all things as one, is a state wherein there is nothing to possess, nothing to own. All things are. There is no one to do the possessing or owning. There's no separate self that has another separate piece of the creation or owns it, or you kind of get to the limits of my language. And finally, the third point is, he said, quote, universal love is defined as realizing a complete awareness of all people and all things. And I may be splitting hairs here, but I see universal love as a necessary and indispensable and central energy to the vision of complete and total unity. Yet universal love, or even love at the level of the Logos, is not yet unity. It is a primal fundamental distortion and the great key, but out of unity / infinity, universal love comes, not vice versa. And that's a helpful thought for me to consider in that question. But about all I have to say on that question. It's a good question.
I've got a sort of a quick answer that piggybacks off of a couple of Gary's points, one being the idea of an intellectual understanding and the incarnational self. Because I do think that despite the semantics that Gary pointed out, that this is a pretty accurate description of the universal love as seen in the light of the Law of One. But there is a paradox that I see within third density, and it's okay for me to accept this paradox where we are, because this is sort of a paradoxical realm. But I think that it makes this truth deeper than we can understand intellectually as third density humans, because we can have an intellectual understanding of the fact that all expressions of all things are our own. Just simply saying that and accepting it as true doesn't necessarily mean we realize that it's true. We kind of have to have faith. And there seems to be a distinction between the way that we express ourselves, my expressions, and somebody else's expressions. I express myself in a certain way after determining it was how I wanted to express myself for whatever reasons. And somebody else expresses themselves in a certain way, and I play no part in the thought processes or the emotional processes behind the way that they express themselves.
Right.
And so only they know their processes, only I know my processes. And from this perspective, there's a really great distinction between our own thoughts and our own expressions, our own emotions, and the thoughts, expressions, and emotions of other selves. It's hard to call them our own thoughts, our own expressions and emotions when we don't know the processes behind them. We have a type of awareness and sovereignty over our own thoughts and emotions and expressions that other people have sovereignty over their own, and we don't really have a say in their sovereignty. So essentially, if all are one, then why are there so many conflicting expressions, conflicting sparks of free will within our realm?
I'm not sure it's as much conflicting as it is other. And I think that when you're around someone for a long time and you start getting to know not the surface thoughts, but what's underneath those thoughts, what's driving those thoughts, what is the essence, then we can come a whole lot closer to walking into each other's auras and sharing each other's energy. It still takes faith. And we have to say, okay, here's how I'm looking at it. Is this matching anything that you're looking at? And it really takes care, patience, and time to come together and really feel that you're tight with somebody on a certain point. It can be done, but I don't think it can be done by those who don't know each other very well, except by an intuitive leap. And Kierkegaard didn't say a leap of faith, by the way. He said a leap into faith. And that's what we're doing. We're leaping into the midair, leaping into faith, that wonderful, mysterious something that solidifies after we've left the cliff. Only then does faith solidify under us and give us a solid place for our feet to walk. So faith is very much underrated in terms of the part it plays in bringing us into harmony. It's not impossible to come into an understanding of someone else. It's improbable. It's difficult. The more that you rest with each other, meditate with each other, and just be with each other, I think the better chance that you'll have of coming together so that you really do feel that you're one. We need training wheels for fourth density. We don't have the knowledge of each other yet. We don't have the knowledge of our own selves very much. Most of us don't. And it's a difficult thing because we keep taking off our mask and then we think, okay, here we are. We're naked. We're real. We're us. And then we discover the mask under the mask. And so we work to take that mask off and be real. And it's a long series of peeling away the enculturated masks, the masks that have been trained into us by family, by teachers, by situations, until we finally do begin to have a good, stern, stout feeling. Okay, this is who I am. I can put my feet here and say, this is what I believe, this is what I honor, this is who I am. Then you're ready to start working with other people to come together. Mickey, what do you think about all this?
Well, we've spent billions of years as sparks of the Creator, individualized souls, trying to individualize ourselves, come through earth, wind, fire, and water, and we finally become some sort of a animal of second density that can turn toward the light, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And what gets us into third density is by further individualizing ourselves, being able to have a conscious identity and be able to give and receive love, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then here we have this choice to make. And the choice has got a whole lot to do with how to return, how to become one again when we've been so working so hard for so many millions and billions of years to become individualized. So it's kind of like overcoming some momentum. But that seems to be the name of the game. The more that we can have faith in the fact that we are one with the Creator, then the more both statements are true, that we as individualized souls are responsible for everything we see and do. And also it's true that the Creator, which is our larger self, is responsible for it all. So, it's one of those paradoxes, I think. We work real hard to become individuals, and then we work probably just as hard to become one again. And all that time, we're still one.
On the essential plane.
Yeah, in truth.
The idea of knowing who you are is so wrapped in my mind with honor. If you can be a person of honor, if you can keep your promises, I think that people can trust you, and trust is the essential when it comes to being able to work with someone else. You've got to be able to trust them. They have to be able to trust you. Gary, what do you think?
Oh, that was, I shared my answer and I didn't have any further thoughts to offer.
Okay. Austin, are you out?
I think we all expended everything we've got.
Okay.
We left it all on the floor.
I think the main point, especially for me, you kind of even wrapped up my point, Carla, was that the definition that he gives, the Adonai one gives, mm-hmm. of universal love is one taken in faith. It's not necessarily an intellectual understanding, and I think all four of us have kind of parroted that idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All righty. Thank you for the question, Adonai one. Our next one, let me see how much time we have left. We got about 15 minutes left. Our next one is sort of a long question from Nick via Bring Forth. Nick asks, to begin, I have to quote something Kuo said. From a session on November 30th, 1986, Kuo says, we realize the difficulty that any seeker of truth meets when looking upon the illusion which is your world. There is much of sorrow and suffering which seems without just cause and even more seemingly tragic without a possible resolution. We can only suggest to each that one attempts to look beyond the outer appearance of any situation and see the heart of all entities and events as being the one Creator, knowing itself in yet another way that might seem incomprehensible, yet in such mystery lies infinite potential for love to be found, for indeed, there is no thing or being made of any other substance. In the Law of One, and now this is back to Nick, Nick says, in the Law of One, Ra also says, the most balanced reaction to any type of catalyst is love. Recently, someone that I am very fond of opened up to me and told me about how she had been raped when she was a teenager. It was from someone random who seemed clearly disciplined in manipulation and negativity. He was extremely abusive verbally and psychologically, and in the end, this person got away. It is one of the most awful things I have come across in my life, and shortly after the sharing of information, three other individuals synchronistically came to me days after and told me about rapes that had occurred to them years ago, too.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself still disturbed and shocked by this type of experience, and where I was once openly loving and trusting of people in public, I am now more wary, sad, and distrusting. So my question then is, how does one go about forgiving someone or something that is incomprehensible or unacceptable? The ultimate objective of Third Density is to know that this moment contains love, and Kuo talks about being able to accept that which is unacceptable, to be aware of the murderer, rapist, thief, is also the self and the creator. I find myself severely confused and uncertain how I could possibly let this type of infringement go. Jesus found power in forgiveness, and Ra said it stopped the wheel of karma, yet I find this impossible to do so. I see how it is empowering me. For the first time in my life, I have considered and taken up martial arts, but I fear that this will only strengthen the anger and the pain that I feel in hopes that I catch and hurt someone doing this to someone else. How does one go about seeing the infinite potential of love at all? Are we to simply forgive the one who is the rapist? I just don't understand how to see love in this or how to forgive, if that is the appropriate step towards the Creator. I mean, I want to forgive. There is so much freedom and feeling of forgiveness and being able to let go, but it seems beyond my power. That is a doozy, Nick.
That is indeed.
I think if one... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Carla.
Please, go ahead.
I think third density entities under the veil, especially third density beings on this planet, can be monsters. Absolutely horrific people doing horrific things. And if you examine the current state of the world, if you look at how a lot of people seem to behave on this planet now, and if you look back through history with the same eye, you'll find countless examples. You could fill books and books and books with examples of the way that people hurt one another and are horrible to one another on this planet. And in so doing, your perspective can become jaded. I mean, you can justify, like Nick is describing, this sort of state of mind where he feels wary and distrustful because he looks at people around him and she sees what they're potentially capable of, sees what kind of shadow that they harbor inside. But that's one of the whole objectives of spirituality, is to not feed that perspective per se. Recognize it, certainly. See what is there. But spirituality calls you forward because you're aware that there is a higher vision or a deeper vision. Certainly what happens on the surface happens on the surface, but there is a greater story. There's a greater narrative. There's a greater context. There's a greater meaning. So you search for that. And the best way to make contact with that, as the Confederation says, as all research says, and all mystics report, is through silence and meditation and going within and sort of suspending the intellect for a time to abide in that deeper current of silence. And there's information there. There's a disclosure of that higher vision, that greater reality. And it becomes an experience. And out of that experience of the greater reality arises forgiveness. Forgiveness, you can certainly lead yourself to forgiveness through an intellectual process of thinking it through and formulating a perspective wherein you recognize that the murderer and the rapist is indeed one with you, and the intellect can set you in that direction. But ultimately, the act of forgiveness is an act of faith, and again, that arises out of actual contact with the deeper truth of the situation. You see what is on the surface, but you look through it to what is in reality happening. And in reality, what's happening is that everybody is, I mean, many ways to describe it, but that we're all one. And that the horrible things that people do are often done because they too are working in the dark and are making bad decisions with incomplete information, and they're disconnected from the source, from that creative reality, and in that darkness, these sort of bad decisions arise. So you can have some kind of, you can put that person and their actions, place them into the greater context, and see that the decisions they make are only because the environment is created whereby they can make those decisions. And in that blindness, they do bad things. And my final thought is that forgiveness isn't, from what I understand regarding forgiveness, isn't so much about the person, not condoning the actions per se, but it's more about yourself and freeing yourself from the need to punish or destroy or hurt that other person, and freeing yourself from the need to live in a fear-based or paranoid or defensive sort of life. That's it for me. You guys?
Well, you know, the thing of it is, what would you do if you had the guy and it was your responsibility to punish him or do whatever? Likely, it would be an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and you'd end up on the same level as that guy, thereby extending the illness of this society, its predilection for violence. The Hawaiians have a wonderful healing method called Ho'oponopono. And in this, the guy takes a look at the murderer, the rapist. He takes a look not at him, not at him personally, but at the guy's case sheet, you know, what he's got on paper. He reads his case, he reads all that the guy's done. And then he retires to his office, puts his feet up, and searches within to find that part of himself, the murderer and the rapist within himself. Now, he hasn't obviously expressed it. He hasn't acted it out. But it's in there, as is every emotion. When he finds it, he heals it in himself. And it has been found in one study that I read that it's extremely successful at altering the behavior of previously stuck people. Those who won't eat, start eating. Those who won't take medication, start taking it, responding to it. Those who are boiling over with fury, become calm. And the guy has never even talked to these people. He has done the work on himself. So, as Gary said, it's a lot about our finding those despicable types of shadow personality within ourselves. Finding them, facing them, forgiving them, and redeeming them by asking them to use that energy to work for the light. Guys, anybody else?
I just want to make a quick note that if we happen to go over on our time, anybody that is listening right now, you can catch the rest of the show from our archive, blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. One of the points I really want to make is that Quo says, attempt to look beyond the outer appearance of any situation and see the heart of all entities. And I think that there is a key point here in the word attempt, And I think that even in asking this question, Nick is attempting to do this, which is essentially fulfilling Kuo's suggestion. There's power in the attempt to find love in all things. And even if we aren't successful, if we make a habit of looking for it, for aiming for forgiveness and acceptance, and even if we aren't successful, our attempt carries a type of spiritual significance. And we shouldn't be hard on ourselves if the attempt doesn't yield a complete acceptance or forgiveness right away. We have to be able to forgive ourselves even for not being able to forgive somebody else, as long as we are seeking to find that forgiveness. But obviously that's not an excuse to stop looking. It's not an excuse to stop asking the hard questions like this question. And it's not an excuse to stop a striving for love and acceptance where it seems to evade us. And in this case, this is probably one of the hardest questions we can ask ourselves in this realm, is how can we forgive and accept a rapist? Personally, in contemplating such heinous acts, I've found one aid in coming to some sort of acceptance or forgiveness is in contemplating the life circumstances of somebody who might do something like that. It seems likely to me that somebody capable of such an act grew up in an environment that probably damaged them in some way. And it's easy for me to see them as damaged or ill rather than just a sort of archetypal bad guy. There was likely something that caused them a great psychological damage that has not yet been healed, and they themselves have a potential to be healed. Just like their victim also has the potential to be healed.
And I want to say, by the way, before we run out of radio time, guys, we love you all. We really do. And we're so glad to be talking with you and sharing energy with you today. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't have actually a whole lot more to say. Jim, do you have anything to add?
No, that's fine. You guys have done great.
Well, we can go ahead and end it there then, before our time is up. You've been listening to LL Research's In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Talk with you then.
Haunting and told me I'm